Good evening. You're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Danielle Kading. Election season is full of political ads and stops on the campaign trail, and last week, Congressman Sean Duffy stopped in several northern Wisconsin counties for town hall meetings. The incumbent House Republican is running for his fourth term in the 7th Congressional District. In the next hour, we bring you the issues on people's minds at his town hall meeting in Superior last week. Voters listened to Duffy talk about the role of government and politics in this election year, including the passing of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. Supporters and opponents asked the House Republican about his thoughts on pension and veterans benefits, gay marriage, the Constitution, immigration, and more. Up first is a question from Stan Wolf of Superior about the Central States Pension Fund.
Right. I want to know what you're going to do to help us with our pension fund. I'm a retired UPS driver. I worked for UPS for 33 years. I belong to 346 in Duluth. We've had lots of meetings over there. Klobuchar, Nolan, Franken have all been there to back everybody. We were down to Minneapolis here last week. Feinberg was there from the Treasury Department. And apparently Central States and the Treasury Department are hooked up somehow. You know, and people think that that pension is free, but we paid into that pension. You know, there's widows who get half of their husband's pension when they die, and now they're going to get cut in half again. You know, there's a lot happening in Minnesota, and I don't hear anything happening in Wisconsin. I did work for a Minnesota company, but I still live over here. I pay taxes over here.
Maybe we can chat and you can bring me up to speed.
Well,
is it my responsibility?
Well, I mean, Nolan and the Minnesota,
hold on a second. Is it my responsibility? You're a private employee, right? You don't work for the government. You work for a private company.
Right.
My responsibility, your government, your taxpayer's responsibility is what?
I know, but the government can bail out Wall Street, General Motors. You know, Feinberg said, well, there's a law, but the Pension Reform Act. Well, they're going to have to change that law, and we need backing to do that.
And I'm one who doesn't believe that we should have bailed out Wall Street banks, or I don't believe we should bail out anybody. I think there's a certain role for the American taxpayer, and I think it's to fund our national defense. I think it's to build infrastructure, bridges, and roads. But I think you bring up a good point. What happens when you have widows and, you know, people who set up their retirement around these dollars? And I don't know what happened with the mismanagement of your fund.
Look what it's going to do to the economy up here. You know, I mean, everything's moving out of Superior the way it is. You know, it's going to hurt. It's definitely, you know, this is affecting about 400,000 Teamsters through the United States. And not only is it going to hurt here, it's going to hurt all over, you know. You know, I'm a Vietnam veteran. I served my country, and now this is going to happen. As usual, the Vietnam vets are down the tube, you know.
If you want to talk after, I'd like to get more information on it.
I could have brought you tons of stuff. I mean, I probably know more of what's going on with it. I've been to I don't know how many meetings.
Can I just tell you what I think would be a great idea? This we're coming into an election cycle. I think it would be a beautiful demonstration. I think it would be a beautiful demonstration of the Teamsters to say, I care more about my union members than I do about politics. And I'm going to put all the money that I would have put into a political campaign, I'm going to put it back into that pension fund. I'm not going to ask the taxpayers to bail us out. I'm going to say, I'm not going to play politics this cycle. I'm going to take care of the men and women who deserve the pension that they plan for.
Okay, I don't want to take up any more time. The United Parcel Service was the largest contributor to Central States Pension Fund. They paid Central States $6.1 billion to get out of the pension fund. They've got their own. That money just disappeared. I mean, there's something crooked going on with Central States, and if politicians don't do something about it, who's going to do it?
If there's something crooked and people have committed crime, I think we do have a duty and an obligation there. So we won't take any more time. If you want, we can talk after, okay? By the way, thank you for your service.
Up next is a question from Holly Erickson of Superior about the U.S. Supreme Court.
if the Congress and the Senate in particular will stand firm, though you're not a senator, but will they hold off on any advocate that would, you know, let me put it to you this way. You know that in 2014, we had a massive revolt against the current policies that we have been laboring under this administration. 2014 was a referendum year, okay? And I feel very strongly that the appointment, in particular, with such a divided court, needs to rest in the hands of us, the taxpayers, that are going to wind up paying through the nose for every other thing that we're being, you know, we need to keep someone that is going to be true to that Constitution we hold most dear. So will the body politic stand firm in saying no to an appointment, recess appointment by President Obama?
You hear that? That's the question about what's going to happen with Justice Scalia's seat. Just so you guys know, I'm in the House of Representatives. We don't confirm appointees by the president. This will rest in the hands of the Senate. I think we should all be honest with each other. And when it was George Bush who was the president and the Democrats controlled the Senate, Republicans said, of course we should put his nomination forward and the Senate should approve him. And Democrat senators said, of course we shouldn't do that. We should wait. And now those institutions have flipped, and so too have the positions of both parties. And now Obama, who filibustered Supreme Court nominees, now says, you need to vote on mine and probably pass my nominee to the Supreme Court. And Republicans will now say, well, of course we should wait till the next president's elected. This is a political issue. Be honest. Depending on who controls the Senate and the White House will determine what position political parties take. What will happen is the president will make an appointment. I'm sure it'll be a very interesting appointment that'll put Republicans in a very hard place. He's very effective that way. And I have to imagine that, I would imagine the Senate will hold hearings, but I don't know that you'll see a nominee get through if I'm reading the tea leaves from what I hear these senators say. But if no matter what side of the aisle you're on, you'd be another side if these two institutions were flipped. So I think it's important that we recognize everyone's hypocrisy in how this works based on your ideology and your philosophy. Fair enough?
Up next is a question from Suzanne Thatcher of Superior about sanctuary cities.
With the Syrian refugees and what we're hearing, and, you know, we all want to be, good to people that are immigrants coming into our country and being fair and rescuing them from, you know, bad situations, persecution. And I'm just wondering what are you hearing as far as sanctuary cities in Wisconsin? You know, I've gotten some emails about would Superior accept them, you know, and would you be willing to take them? And I'm just wondering as far as, you know, at a state level, what are we hearing as far as, you know, thoughts on bringing in refugees and sanctuary cities here?
I think they're two different issues. So refugee coming in, if they do come, they would come lawfully. They wouldn't be coming illegally. So sanctuary cities wouldn't apply. The sanctuary cities apply to cities that say, I know that I have those who have come without documentation, they're not here legally, and we're not going to enforce federal law, we're going to let them stay and we're going to protect them. On the city front, I think Milwaukee and Superior and Madison might have a different opinion maybe than Wausau or Green Bay or Eau Claire or Hudson, I think just based on the makeup of each of the cities. I've heard there's a bill on sanctuary cities going through the state legislature,
yes.
And I'm not, it did, on the assembly, and I'm not that familiar with it. I believe that we should enforce our laws. I think that we need to secure a border. I also think after you secure the border, you have to treat people fairly who have come here. Listen, if anybody thinks that you'll milk cows in Wisconsin if everyone was arrested and sent home, you're crazy. It's not going to happen. Treat people fairly, but also we have to get to the business of securing the border. And quickly, I think Right now, there's an open border policy by this president. You can come across. It's catch and release. There's no security there. And it's not just people who want to come and work. It's people who, they're the coyotes who are trafficking people, drugs, who knows what, who's coming. They want to, do harm with a certain set of ideologies that don't come from Mexico but come from the Middle East. So I think it's incumbent that we secure the border and as quick as possible.
Up next is a question from Pastor Alan Schroeder of Calvary Baptist Church in Superior about the government's role in the recognition of marriage.
Good evening, Congressman. I'm Alan Schroeder. I pastor Calvary Baptist Church right here in town. And I stand on the absolute truth of God's word, and that's how I live my life. And marriage was created by God in the Garden of Eden. Marriage is not, biblical marriage is not antiquated. I'm a preacher. I've moved my hands a lot. Anyway, I stand on the absolute truth of God's word as far as marriage and traditional family. And even if the whole country says otherwise, I'm going to stand and I'm going to say what's right. Where do you stand on these principles?
So I'm a guy who believes in life at conception, and I believe in traditional marriage, full-heartedly. So I do think there's this debate has raged on the life side for some time, decades. I do think when you have the courts make these decisions instead of people, I do think nine elitist judges who make decisions that are imposed upon the rest of us, and creating rights that I don't think exist in the Constitution,
it's an abuse of power.
Is not the way forward. I do think, and I think Justice Scalia was right on this point. He said, listen, this is not for nine justices. This is for the states. If your state believes in abortion, let them vote on it. If they believe in life at conception, let them vote on it. If they believe in traditional marriage or they believe in something else, let the people decide for themselves. I agree with you. I'm not moving that. I'm a pro-life guy and a pro-marriage guy. But
I'm here to tell you that there would be very few states that would have approved this abomination that we see happening across our land.
It's about re-empowering people to do and live in a society and a culture that they think reflects their values. And the nine justices don't always reflect the values of the people. And when you create things in the Constitution that don't exist, sometimes people might applaud that and go, that's consistent with my values and they like it. But a different court can do different things that are not consistent with your values. I think that's the danger of this stuff. And that's why I think Justice Scalia was so smart to say, these are decisions that people can make themselves. We don't have to make them. But for me personally, I'm a life guy and traditional marriage guy. My eighth kid is on the way. I'm a good Catholic.
Congratulations.
A little crazy. Thanks. Thank you, Bruce.
That's all our questions here, so.
Let's open it up.
You got about a half hour.
Any questions or comments on.
Can I make a comment?
Yeah.
My name is Richard Nolan, and I have a disability, 40% disability from the government. And about this gentleman on 8 years, I went through it in 1970, and I picked up the telephone and called my congressman. It wasn't you. I don't think you were born then.
I came around in 71.
But anyway, I talked to the congressman's people in his office and told her what was going on, and my disability wasn't coming through whatsoever. So she hung up, and the next day she called me back, and she says, is this the only disability, only claim you got into the federal government? I said, yes, or the VA government. And I said, yes. She said, well, this seems awful long. She says, okay, I'll get back to you again. So 2 days later, she called me back and she says, well, we found your claim and you'll have our answer in 2 weeks. So in 2 weeks, my claim come through for 30% disability, and it went up from since then. And that was just because whoever they talked to was sitting in his bottom of his in basket, and he was too lazy to pick up the papers and go through them. I'm not saying that that's what you do, but that's what happened to me the same way. But this was back in the 1970s. And the question I would like to ask you is, I have a 40% disability, but if I had a 50% disability, I would get my retirement pay and my disability pay at the same time. Now, I asked your office, and I will say that I never got an answer from you or the gentleman that's sitting in the back, the heavyset gentleman in the back. I never got an answer from either one of you. I asked if there was something that could be done to where you should receive your disability pay and your retirement pay at the same time, because they're two different entities as far as I'm concerned. And I never got an answer from anybody.
Sorry about that. When was that question
put
over to me?
Probably about 2 years ago.
Okay. Write your question and give me your phone number, and I'll get back to you within a week. Deal?
Well, I might have to vote for you again, but I guess it's a good deal. Vote
for him again, Dick.
The thing is, I'm not a Republican or a Democrat. It's who's going to do the best job for me, not everybody. But
can I tell you on the VA stuff though? I can't guarantee results, but there's a lot we're able to get a lot more movement than sometimes your service officers. And again, sometimes it's not perfect, but the most cases that I handle in my office, so I deal with Social Security and Medicare, I mean, all your government programs I can deal with through my office. Mm-hmm. By far the number one issue that I deal with is VA issues, because it's so messed up, and I take it to heart. I value the men and women who served, and I do the best I can to get you positive results, and I put a lot of effort into it and a lot of resources in my office into trying to get
results. I'm just probably saying that they just probably hit it right. That they got it within a time, and that, you know, I was going to write them a letter and thank you, and the lady said, "Don't, because I'm writing down everything you say right now, because I thought they did a super job to get it that quick." And then later on, I was reevaluated, and the gentleman that reevaluated me gave me another 10% because of what was wrong.
Give me your information again, and then I'll grab it from the after.
You're listening to a recording of a town hall meeting hosted in Superior last week by Congressman Sean Duffy on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're going to take a short break for these announcements. I'm Danielle Kading, and this is Hear Me Out. Good evening. You're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Danielle Kading. In this hour, we're broadcasting a recording of a town hall meeting hosted in Superior last week by Congressman Sean Duffy. Up next are comments and questions from Glenn Bayless of Superior.
First of all, I want to congratulate you. You are not one of the rhinos that just kind of acts the part. You voted against the omnibus spending bill. You've done some great things, you've stood your ground where you felt you've needed to, and I appreciate that. A lot of the Republican candidates are talking about a wall, a fence, you know, the whole Mexican border thing. If someone does put up a bill. I have two questions. This is number one. If someone does put up a bill to build a wall, to enhance the border security, what are your thoughts on that? And the second thing is, what specific bills have you put forth to help the people of Wisconsin?
So those are very good questions. So in regard to the border, we've already sent, I mean, this goes back to Reagan, where there was an exchange for giving people amnesty for then later border security, and amnesty came and border security never arrived. So I think at this point we're saying we want border security first. What does border security look like? How do you verifiably secure your border? That is a very complex question on what does that mean and how do you verify it? And so whether if that's through bricks and mortar, if that's through fences, if that's through technology, I don't know what the right answer is. I think we want to have the most cost-effective means possible to secure the border and make sure we get to determine who comes in and who goes out. And I think we want to expand our work visas. So if we do have parts of our economy where we don't have people filling the employment needs, we can easily bring them in. And we can easily say no to folks as well who might, we don't have a lot of welders, but let's say we did have a lot of welders. And if we bring in Mexican welders, all of a sudden you're going to drive down the wages of our welders because this is basically a supply and demand issue. I think we have to be very cautious about making sure we're supporting the American workforce and not bringing in people to compete with Americans. We want to bring in people to actually try to fill the spaces that our American employees aren't filling or can't fill. So that's my view on that. So I'm on the banking committee, which is called the Financial Services Committee. So it's banks, insurance, housing, the Fed, and so there's a lot of all the committees in the House. They have tax writing, they have energy and commerce. They all think they're really great committees. If something goes wrong in financial services, you don't know in a year or a month. You know today. All of a sudden the world starts to collapse when markets go bad or banks go bad. And so what I've done is, I don't think our communities work unless our small community banks and our credit unions work. In small America, I think it's important to have banks that are run and owned in our local communities, where decisions aren't made in Minneapolis or Chicago or New York, that we make them here. And I don't know if you guys have seen this, but around our district and around the country, small banks are forced to consolidate or shut down, or credit unions are consolidating or shutting down, and you're seeing more power and control leave your community and go somewhere else. And I think when you have a bank that is a community bank from your community, they know your families. They know your parents. They know your brothers and sisters. They know your businesses. They'll take a risk on a business that employs a lot of families because they know if that business goes out, what impact that has in their community. And they're really good at it. They're specialized in a community. You're seeing after Dodd-Frank that all the rules and regulations that were meant for Wall Street, they've hit Wall Street, but they have the economies of scale. They're big banks. They can hire lawyers and compliance officers. But the small community banks, they can't deal with this new cost of compliance, and so they're getting out of the business. And the ones that suffer, who had nothing to do with the 08 financial crisis, are our communities. And so I'm fighting to make sure we have some relief for the community banks. And we don't have check-the-box banking. They can actually go, I know these people. I know they'll give their firstborn child. They'll pay the loan back. I know they will. This is how things have worked, and it's been pretty effective in America. We got to get back to some of those basics, and so that's what I'm working on. I'm trying to let Wisconsinites in the western side of our state get Packer games. It's been a hard go of it.
That's okay.
No, you're a Viking fan?
No, we need more Packer games on TV in this area. Absolutely.
These are not big economic ones that I'm referencing. Oh, did anyone notice if you go to a game recently that you don't see your military jets fly over anymore?
Why is that?
Border security.
So remember during the government shutdown, the World War II memorial, which is an open-air memorial.
Yeah, he shut it off.
The president spent a lot of money to bring out barricades and barricade the World War II memorial, which is an open-air memorial and doesn't cost anything to let people go in and see it, to make a point. So since sequester, in essence, the Pentagon has shut down these flights over our stadiums. And listen, I think it pays tribute to the men and women who serve. I think it's a reminder for everybody that we have men and women who are still in harm's way serving our country. I'm proud of my country when you see those jets roar over. So I introduced a bill. It's called the Sound of Freedom Act, which, because that's the sound of freedom you hear coming over the stadium, to say let's let the National Guard units in each state make the determination on whether they do the flyover or not. It doesn't cost any more money. They have their locked training hours they have to do. Yes. Let them partake in those training hours and do flyovers. I think it's good for our country. It's patriotic. Wow. It's a reminder. And so that's a simple one, but I know that our guys in Wisconsin would they have no problem flying over Lambeau, and you'd see those jets roar over every Packer game. So, again, those are some small things. I think the budget that we're working on is important to make sure we have. I'm sorry, this is the last thing I'll mention. We have $19 trillion in debt. $19 trillion. The interest on the debt is $250 billion a year. $250 billion. Now, I think most of us don't know what that means. But how much is two? I can't comprehend. So I have to compare it to other expenses. So for our military, we spend about $550 billion. So about half of what you spend for your military a year, you pay just to service your debt. Food stamps, you pay $80 billion a year, but $80 billion for food stamps, $250 to service your debt. Infrastructure, about $50 billion. It should actually be about $100 billion we should spend on infrastructure. We're so behind, but $250 billion just on interest on your debt. Obama says in the 10-year window, President Obama, that we're going to spend $800 billion, almost $1 trillion, just on interest on our debt. So if people say we can keep spending and borrowing, the cost of servicing the debt is substantial. We need to get our act together and balance the budget and start to pay it down, because anyone, if you put any money in the bank now, you don't get any interest on your money. But when interest rates go to historic norms, to service this debt is going to be absolutely crushing. And so, but the only way that's going to happen is if all of you stand up and demand that we figure out solutions to solve this problem. And it won't be a Paul Ryan budget or a Nancy Pelosi budget. It's going to be something what we don't have right now, but it's going to be a compromise between both sides that the American people demand that we get done, we fix, and get in a path to balance and paying off the debt. So we're working on that as well. Anything else from you?
Up next is a comment from Gary Barrett of South Range about veterans benefits.
When I first filed my claim, I got a letter back from Milwaukee saying, oops, we lost your claim. She said, we know you sent it. Could you refile? And it seems like, you know, is it repeating here? You know, and now, like I say, flipping the papers over, I kept getting shuffled to the bottom of the pile. Every time I requested something or they requested something from me, my file went to the bottom of a pile. Instead of just adding to it, they made me start all over again. And that's why mine has actually taken over 8 years to settle. It's like from 70 to 2016, it's still going on. I guess more what I'm saying is maybe it's more fuel for you to help, you know, straighten this out, this mess that, you know, they keep flipping the papers upside down.
What business could operate in your community where they treat people this way?
Kmart.
Oh, they would get bounced out of town. They wouldn't get any business.
That's where they're going. Right? That's
how they operate.
But they're gone now. Because they will be put out of business. And so the VA treats people so poorly because you don't have another option. And I think this is what big government looks like. I think you should have an option to say, let me opt out. Let me go get care in my community. Let me find a way to quickly resolve my claim. I might not like it, but I get a resolution that I think is fair. And I'll tell you one of the problems, though, if the American Legion and the VFW, and they'll all stand opposed to letting you out of the system and get into your local care in your community, which I think is a problem. Maybe not as much for you guys, but you get a little further away from some of the hospitals, and it becomes really problematic for folks in more rural parts of the state. So, but good point. Thank you.
For a medical condition that I acquired from when you get your inoculations, I got hepatitis when I was in, and they won't do nothing for, you know, the cost of it, the hundreds of thousands of dollars that it acquires.
Your hearing?
Yeah, my hearing. You know, 10 years in the field artillery was.
Up on the air.
Yes.
I used to do the hot saws without ear muffs back in the day, and it does something on mine too. I don't, but that's not artillery. You take the cake. No. Mm-hmm. Anybody else?
Up next is a question, once again, from Holly Erickson of Superior about the status of cost of living adjustments for those receiving veterans benefits.
I don't know, maybe it was a couple $100 for each veteran. That legislation, I think, had been introduced. I know I don't know how to put it any better than that.
But this year, I think mostly because of gas prices, there wasn't a cost of living increase with Social Security as well. But yeah, remember what I talked about earlier? This has all been outsourced to regulators in the executive branch. And on this one, Congress, before I was there, said, let's let Social Security make a determination in regard to the cost of living, because if the cost of living doesn't increase, I'm going to get pressure anyway from my seniors to increase their Social Security, and we'll all say yes to it, so let's take it out of our hands and give it to someone else. We should make that decision in Congress. We're all big boys and girls. We should make tough decisions, and we shouldn't have given that power up, but I'm saying the Congress that have all come before me have given up all this power and authority.
I don't know which takes it
away from all of you.
I know the gas prices went down, but my gosh, these last 7 years, everything else has gone up and up. We're talking energy prices, food prices. It cost, when we moved to Wisconsin 8 years ago, our yearly real estate tax was somewhere in the neighborhood of $2,000. Then before Governor Walker got elected in, it got all the way up within a brief amount of time to $2,600. Now it's coming back down by degrees, but we have seen our energy costs, which used to average $270 a month, increase to $450 a month on the average 12-month plan. You know, now for those of us that are wounded warriors and living on a fixed veteran's income such as we are, you know, so the gas prices went down, but my gosh, everything else is going through the roof. And there has got to be, you've got to find a way, an equitable way, a bipartisan way. Maybe not everybody is so polarized that you could come up with an accountant's honest estimate as to how the cost of living really does increase. Maybe you pull some accountants from all 50 states and say, you're it. Find a way. Find out how to peg that cost of living to the dollars that actually are spent. Because I don't think anyone in Washington has any clue. You've got five of the most rich counties in America are D.C. and surrounding. And if you plunk these guys here, it would be a wake-up call. But no one understands. You do. I shouldn't say no one. Many do not understand. And this is part of the level of frustration that is driving this very peculiar election year.
It is peculiar, that is for sure. But you make a good point, and that is our effort as we go into this year. One of the things we're examining is how do we take control back in the Congress? Because, again, that means you have power and control when I have a say, and Tammy Baldwin and Ron Johnson also have a say. Mm-hmm. Can I bring up one other issue for you guys? I think one of the most important things that we do in our country, the most important thing that we do is educate our kids. If you don't educate your kids, you have no future. I mean, you really don't. And one thing that concerns me is you start to see a fracture with parties and education, and we shouldn't see that. But I have a lot of little ones. My kids know more about global warming than they do about their founding fathers.
Yes.
There's a lot of politics that are being driven in. Do anyone have kids that they disagree with me that that's happening? I mean, that concerns me. And then when you get to the university system, the Wisconsin University system, does anybody know what the number one most required reading in the University of Wisconsin system is? Anyone? Any takers? It's the Communist Manifesto. Karl Marx. I don't know that this is for history to show what people thought were great ideas, but when put in practice, how bad those ideas actually turned out to be. I think this is oftentimes being promoted. Why do you think we have so many millennials stand behind Bernie Sanders feeling the burn? Socialism doesn't lift people out of poverty. Socialism doesn't offer more opportunity. Socialism if you look at history, has never done what free enterprise has done for people, but you have a revisionist history by maybe it's the Birkenstock wearing 60, you know, radicals that are now in universities promoting this stuff to our kids who now have a very favorable opinion of socialism. 43% of college kids have a favorable view of socialism. And so these institutions are funded with our tax dollars, a lot of our tax dollars. That concerns me. I think that we shouldn't indoctrinate our kids. We should actually educate them. And we should talk about competing views on economics, but we shouldn't just drive one view of economics to our children. So look at what's happening in Brazil and Venezuela. Look what happened in Cuba. Look what happened in the Soviet Union. I think the evidence is quite clear. So why are we driving these principles to our young kids? I don't know. I think it's a problem that I think it's incumbent upon all of us to take a look at.
Up next is a question again from Pastor Alan Schroeder.
One other question I had. We've got a president who loves to use his pen to make executive orders. I look at that as an abuse of power in many ways. An executive order by a president is supposed to be the exception, not the rule. I believe that he's acting more like a dictator than a president. How do you feel about this, and what can you do in Congress to reverse this or oppose it?
So I think it's important to be honest. Like I said about the Supreme Court, and both sides of the aisle would flip if the chambers were flipped. George Bush loved executive orders too. Now his were different. The kind that Barack Obama has implemented, I think, are on the verge of legislation and changing the will of the Congress, the bills that we passed, to mean something else. Bush didn't do that, but Bush loved executive orders. Executives love the power of the executive, whether they're Republicans or Democrats. And I think, again, it's our job to start to regarner some of this power and control. It's important to have the courts look at what the president has done and through the courts contain some of that power and overreach. But I'm not that concerned about the executive orders, because all the stroke of those executive order pens can be undone with one signature by the next president. It really can. So I know everyone gets geared up about that, but they can all be undone by the next president. By the way, I think it was the Washington Post that gave us the site for the Communist Manifesto in Wisconsin, so that's where that comes from, if you want your site. Any other questions or comments for me? I got a lively group here. That rain took you guys down a couple notches, I guess.
Well, at least it's raining.
It's snowing. Yeah. Wait till it freezes, and then.
Freezes.
Yes. That's right. Anything else? Anything else we should be looking out for? Yeah.
Do you know what the status is now of Medicare?
What's going to happen with Medicare?
Yes.
So Medicare is on a pathway to insolvency. And the reason is that three things are happening. One, we have all these baby boomers who are in or coming into their retirement. So you have this whole swath of people that are going to start tapping into Medicare. Healthcare costs, contrary to the president's promises, are actually increasing, not decreasing. And modern medicine is a beautiful thing. We live longer. So because we don't die earlier, we spend more time on some of this assistance. And it's those three things taken together cause real pressure on Medicare. And so what we've talked about was, if you're in your retirement or you're near your retirement, you have to keep the same benefit package that currently exists. But we have to make some modifications for the next generation. And we've talked about premium support as one method to do it. But we have to have some modifications if we're going to make Medicare solvent and make sure that future generations get the promise of Medicare. And, you know, our concern is if you take Medicare, Social Security, and interest on the debt, those three things will consume everything in not too long. So we got to make sure that we meet promises, but also set expectations appropriately for the next generation so they can set up their own retirement in a way that that they can save accordingly. So, but again, we put out plans. You need to have everybody put out plans and have a raucous debate, an American conversation, and then have an American fix. It's not going to be one party or one view. Everybody's going to have to work together to get to a solution on this stuff. But it does take everybody engaging. And when you talk about this or you vote on this kind of stuff, you've seen a little bit of it, but the Wausau media market hits a majority of our district. I have the political scars on my back to prove that millions of dollars are run against you in ads to demonize and misrepresent what you've done. So, but that's a good question. So just, you know, I'm committed to making sure we meet the promise to you and making sure we're able to meet the promise of Medicare and Social Security to future generations.
You're listening to a recording of a town hall meeting hosted in Superior last week by Congressman Sean Duffy on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're going to take a short break for these announcements. When we come back, we'll have more discussion and an interview with the third-term House Republican. I'm Danielle Kading, and this is Hear Me Out. Good evening. You're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Danielle Kading. In this hour, we're broadcasting a recording of a town hall meeting hosted in Superior last week by Congressman Sean Duffy. Up next, once again, is a question from Holly Erickson of Superior.
You know, right now we've got a lot of people out of the labor force. And one of the things that, wouldn't it be true that would help boost all of our social programs would be if we could re-employ our own people, then you would have those taxpayers paying into Social Security, paying into Medicare, because it comes on your, you know, your little payroll stub that so much went in. And, you know, it seems to me that part of the key of making Medicare and Social Security so that they are going to be solvent would be to get everyone off the dole that you could, you know, to boost, to unleash the economic power that we have in this country, you know.
So that's a good point. Let me maybe follow it up with a question. So I believe that we should have a safety net, and I think you probably do too, a safety net, because, listen, people fall on hard times, and when they do, I think it's important to help people back up. And I'd like to see our churches and our community organizations be on the front line of that, but I think there's a role for your government to step in and help as well. So with that said, and I'm a believer that you got to help and care for people in times of need, does anybody in this room know of a friend, a family member, or a neighbor who is getting benefits that they probably don't deserve? They could probably get back into the workforce, but they're taking something that they probably don't need to take. Raise your hand if you know someone. A couple of you know someone. The other guys don't know anybody who's getting benefits. I have friends and family members that I know that can go back to work that are getting assistance. And I think there's a deal where there's a lot of people who work two and three jobs to make ends meet and pay taxes. And so it's important that we keep our social safety net for those who need to be in the safety net. And those who are in it that don't need to be in, need to make sure we find a way to get them back out and into the workforce. I think one of the things that we do wrong is if you're getting help and you go back to work, you lose all the help that you're getting. And so it's a disincentive to go back to work. So there has to be a way to get people back into the workforce and then more gradually reduce their help, taper it. And this is just common sense stuff. Mm-hmm. And so in a way, the program is a disincentive to get back into the workforce, where if you were actually incentivizing folks to get back in, you'd see far better results. And one of the problems I hear now is that we can't fill a lot of the jobs that we have in a lot of different, you know, pockets of our state. So that's going to take a little bit of work, though, to make sure we make those transitions. Yeah.
Well, you're young.
I'm getting great.
Up next is a comment from Jerry Barrett of South Range.
Of millions of dollars overseas to feed the hungry, to house the hungry, you know, to give them medication. I have no problem with that. But damn it, feed our own people, house our own people, make sure our own people are taken care of first.
Yeah.
You know?
Common sense, huh? Yeah. Point well made. Point well made. Any other last takers of a comment or a question? Stay dry. God bless and have a good night.
You're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Danielle Kading. We caught up with Congressman Sean Duffy after the town hall meeting to ask a few questions about his run for a fourth term in the 7th Congressional District.
Right now I don't have a challenger, and for me it's a nice relief because I've had tough races every year, but I'm sure I'll have a Democrat challenger in this election cycle. And for me it doesn't really change what I do. I'm out working hard all the time. Whether there's a challenger or not, I'm out doing town halls and coffees with your congressman because it's important for me to get feedback. So regardless of who comes in, nothing changes for me.
Well, and Kirk Bangstad, he was the one challenger that you did have, but then he dropped out. And he said in an email to supporters that part of the reason for that was he couldn't raise enough money. And you have over $1 million in cash on hand right now, and you're one of three congressmen in the state that does. Well, that would be Democrat Ron Kind and also Paul Ryan. So do you think that money wins elections, or what wins elections in your mind?
So if you recall back in 2010, I ran against a congressman who was the chairman of appropriations, one of the most powerful committees in all of Washington. And when I started, he had hundreds of thousands of dollars, and I had nothing. And I ran hard. I brought my message to the people who then decided to help me out. It's always hard to get resources to run a race, but people have to buy into your message, and you have to work hard to do it. And I don't chair a committee like appropriations like Dave Obey chaired. So, you know, the people tell me it's hard. Tell me about it. I know. I did it. But you got if you don't work hard to get people to buy into your message, then you can't complain that people aren't helping you out. And I work really hard to touch and work for my constituents, and that's why people buy in to my race on the political side and help me out.
Tonight we heard a lot about veterans issues, aging issues, pension, gay marriage. What are you hearing from voters in the district? Are the top concerns on their mind?
See, I think what I hear is what's reflected in the presidential campaign. So I hear a lot about immigration. I'll hear a lot about income inequality. I'll hear about some of the social issues, but I hear about jobs and good-paying jobs and upward mobility, and I hear about a stagnant recovery, and people have more jobs, but the jobs aren't paying as much as they probably should to allow people to create a good environment to raise a family. So those issues, I think people are now more concerned about our security. They look at what happened in France and then San Bernardino, and they feel that ISIS has grown in strength and stature, that they can threaten us in the homeland. And they want to make sure that their Congress and their government keep them safe. And I think the president's lackluster response, not just to Paris but to San Bernardino, don't make people feel safe. And the fact that ISIS continues to expand and grow and create more, take more territory and inspire more jihadists makes a lot of Americans uneasy. And the president keeps saying he's going to defeat and destroy them, but it doesn't happen. So I think people question his commitment, number one, or our capabilities.
Given that you're unopposed right now, it's pretty likely that you'll be elected. If elected, then what would you like to accomplish in your next term?
So I'm on the Financial Services Committee, and I think, again, if you want to grow your economy, you have to make sure that you have credit flowing to your families and to your small businesses. And I want to make sure that our community banks and our credit unions continue to work. And so many rules and regulations are a burden on them. I want to make sure that our federal government is responsive to the people. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, it's a great name, but they're taking consumers' credit card information, their mortgage information. If you thought the NSA was bad, the CFPB is 10 times worse, and they're not helping people get credit. They're actually reducing people's ability to get a loan, people who should be able to get a loan. And so I believe in consumer protection, but not in the way that this agency has done that work. I'm going to continue to fight to make sure we get America on a course to balance in our budget. I think that there's a real need to reform the way our entitlements work to make sure that people can get from a place of unemployment and not working back into the workforce. And setting those programs up the right way so people can make that transition, I think, is incredibly important. And so people can also get back into a job that pays them well. And those are the things I want to work on in the next Congress.
And are you throwing your support behind any presidential candidate right now?
So I'm with Marco Rubio. I think he's someone that touches a wide array of people. He has a hopeful message. He's someone who knows what it's like to be raised in an immigrant family. Who lived paycheck to paycheck, putting food on the table. He had to pay for himself to go to school and take out loans. The guy has lived the American dream. He knows what it's like to have tough times. He's lived through it. And I like his hopeful, inspirational message. So I'm with Marco. I think he has the ideas that can grow the economy and also keep us safe. So I'm looking forward to the Marco surge coming in South Carolina and beyond.
And so last question. When you talk to voters and talk about why you deserve to be reelected, what do you cite?
Listen, so for me, no one deserves anything. The electorate always evaluates their candidates and decides whether they give them a second term or not. I'll just say this, I work my heart out. I work to make sure I represent our interests in Washington. And people may not agree with me 100% of the time, but they know that I work hard to know what their opinions are. And when I go to Washington, I fight my heart out to make sure that their voices are heard. And right now, it's not perfect. We don't get a lot of things done in Washington, but I'm fighting to make sure that our ideas, our values, our morals are represented, and I think people appreciate that. And in everything that's happening right now, I think people appreciate that I care about their opinion. I do town halls. I do coffees with your congressman. I do telephone town halls because I care about where people are at, and I won't be able to adequately represent them if I don't know what positions they hold and how they feel about certain issues. And because I do that, and then I go effectively represent them in Washington, I think they'll reward me with their vote. Listen, if I, listen, my mom has a Bernie Sanders burn sticker on the back of her car in a Duffy for Congress. I'm building a bridge from the left to the right, or right to the left, whatever.
You've been listening to a recording of a town hall meeting hosted last week in Superior by Congressman Sean Duffy. That's it for our program. You can hear it again online on our website at wpr.org/superior. You can also find us on our Facebook page at facebook.com/KUWSFM. You've been listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Danielle Kading. Have a great rest of your week.